my formal education has all been with crustaceans and invertebrates. It was only after I started working at the University of Florida that I found the questions of, and I spent a good deal of time trying to figure out how they make a living. While Gagnon and Focus as a study system, at the end of time permitting, I'll make a brief comparison to another grouper to reinforce an important point that a lot of what you're able to do depends on the characteristics of the animal that you're most interested in. And then I'll wrap up with a few take-home remarks. So the question that's been of interest to folks having a desire to improve reef fisheries and particularly to use artificial reefs for a long time has been what's been billed now as the attraction production question. Do artificial reefs produce more fish, thereby improving the overall population? Or do they simply attract the fish that are already there, simply making them easier to catch? The popular and long-standing traditional view, mostly among fishermen, has been that in the seafloor where it's sandy, doesn't hold many fish, or at least darn few reef fish. But once you put structure on the seafloor, and in very short order, you can start to produce from that location reef fish. And so the harvest from those locations goes up. The presumption is then that you have more habitat, you create more fish. Barren sand to lush reef. Back in the mid-1980s, some fisheries scientists, primarily led by Jim Bossett down at the NOAA Fisheries Center in Miami, raised the question, but wait a minute, if we have a population of fish that, say, is unexploited and at this level, and they're fully occupying the available natural habitat, and now you start fishing them down, through a lot of fishing activity, the population as a whole is reduced, but the amount of natural habitat that exists is still where it was back in a higher population level. So under fishing pressure, that population is now limited by the amount of habitat. Right? So adding more habitat isn't going to produce more fish. And so they start this debate. You know, the fishery scientists were interpreting the situation as the high densities of reef fish, artificial reefs, which is pretty well documented, was simply an artifact of behavior. They had no explanation for it, just an artifact of behavior, and all you were doing was increasing fishing mortality. My point of view through research has come to, well, both perspectives have an element of truth to them, but neither of them hit the mark. Right? And what we really need to do is understand how fish depend on habitat and use habitat in order to understand how we can design and employ reef technology to benefit the fish population. Now, I should really back up before showing you this slide. This is where I should give you a disclaimer, kind of like on the evening news where they say, the next few scenes are going to be too intense. If you're uncomfortable, please turn away. The next two slides are going to be the kinds of things that university professors make as, get scoped about. If you find yourself feeling a little queasy, a little lightheaded, just take a few deep breaths, look away, put your head down between your knees. This is going to be more of an academic perspective, but I assure you there's a reason for this. One of the great joys that I have professionally is teaching a graduate course here called Scientific Thinking in Ecology. And it's listed in core curriculum in fisheries and the School of Natural Resources and the Environment as part of core curriculum for critical thinking. It's an introduction to philosophy of science and critical thinking. And on the first day of class, I introduced this diagram to the students. The philosophers and educational psychologists who study how we reason and think tell us everybody thinks according to these eight elements of thought. I won't belabor it, but reasoning has a purpose and it starts with a question and certain concepts that frame it. And whether you're disciplined and scientific or not, this is what we all do. The reason for sharing this is I just told you about the points of view of fisheries scientists and the points of view of fishermen. and we carry different assumptions, different concepts into that question of attraction and production, and we come to different conclusions and different implications. Now, the same is true among scientists from different disciplines when we try to answer these questions. I come at the question as a behavioral ecologist, which is a different point of view than someone who comes at the very same question as a population dynamics person. Right? Or someone who is a marine biologist. Right? So there's different points of view that influence how we understand the question and what we consider to be an answer. That part of it. You know, you can zone out if you want to. Right? This is simply to show that the point of view of a behavioral ecologist comes from a very rich, deep body of ecological literature. The body theory, and I should explain that when an ecologist uses the term theory, and we're not talking about something that is just a wild guess, or my best educated guess, or a possibility. When we use the term theory, we're generally referring to a concept or a suite of concepts that have been well formulated, oftentimes structured mathematically, right, and researched and substantiated through an extensive effort to test and validate and refute different aspects of the theory. So the theory refers to a whole body of knowledge, and how we apply that knowledge then is more than just a guess. Right? But in behavioral ecology, habitat selection is one of the cornerstone theories of the work that we do. And there's a lot of fancy terms and variations on a theme, a lot of mathematics underlying some of these names. But the concept is really very simple. And animals, mobile animals in particular, have three basic resources that they depend on: food, shelter, and mates. Everything they do is about balancing the tensions in acquiring and obtaining food, shelter, and mates. And the rest of it is just variations on a theme and the implications of how different animals solve the problem of getting what they need to live. That's what we study as behavioral ecologists. The concept is really even simpler than that. It's intuitively obvious that habitat differs in its quality. The quality of the shelter that's kept in a patch of habitat is going to differ. There's going to be high-quality habitat and low-quality habitat. Yeah? There's going to be neighborhoods where the real estate value is high, neighborhoods where the real estate value is relatively low. It's just common sense. Right? The theory tells us that the animals should be moving about so that they should choose to occupy the highest quality habitat that's available to them. Right? But once that habitat starts to get occupied, the density of animals increases at that location, so the number of competitors for the resources affects what the individuals can glean from that habitat patch. So as density goes up, the realized value of that habitat goes down, and a critter can go to some other habitat patch and do just as well on a lower quality habitat patch because there's fewer competitors there. And that really is all there is to this body of theory. The rest of it is just, well, what are the implications? How does it play out in nature? Right? The point here is, in habitat selection, does it bother you if I use the cursor to point things? And habitat selection affects the spatial dynamics of mortality and growth of fish. And dead fish and small fish don't reproduce very well. So the consequences to the population can be profound. So as a study system, both in terms of using the artificial reefs as experiments and also going out to natural habitat to study how the fish behavior affects their spatial dynamics for mortality and growth. Right? Now, if you've zoned out, you can come back in and we'll move on to something more interesting. Okay? GAG have what we call a spatially staged structure. Yeah, this is a weird fish, right? Like all groupers, GAG are what we call protodynous hermaphrodites. That means every single one of them starts life as a female. And for these critters, they don't have, only a few of them switch to male late in life in the spawning population. But unlike other groupers, actually start life as young in the year in the seagrass beds, structured habitat right along the shoreline. Right? I'm biased. This is the northeastern Gulf of Mexico where I work. Right? So the Yamagay population is bigger than this, but it shows it for my part of the world. Right? So you have nursery habitat. This spawning actually takes place along the shelf edge break, well offshore, about 250, 300 feet of water. Right? And at those at locations in the offshore area, during the spawning season, which is in the wintertime, you'll have one or a few males, a small number of males, and a large number of females in a pyramid mating system. They get together in these large aggregations, and that's where the spawning occurs. They spawn out here, and then the larvae are carried by the wind-driven currents of the season into these shallow nursery grounds. They leave the nursery grounds as young of the year, that is, in the first year of life, and move out and spend 3 or 4 years as juveniles on the shallow continental shelf. This is a real advantage to us scientifically, because now it means that we can study how habitat affects the growth and performance of juvenile gay without worrying about reproduction getting in the way. Everything we work on in this part of the world are females. You know how simple life is when all you're dealing with are women? It's really made it an ideal study system because it takes some of the complicated features of other systems and removes them. The other benefit is that from a fisheries management perspective, the more you can improve the growth or survival of juvenile fish, the greater the impact on the later population. Right? If you can improve the growth rates of juvenile fish by enhancing habitat at this life history stage, their reproductive potential is far greater once they move offshore. So that's the advantage of our study system. Now, one of the things that we've been able to do over a period of years, I was surprised this evening to see Ryan Field join from a graduate student. Welcome, Ryan. Good to see you again. We've done a number of studies of movement. And movement is kind of a mortar that melds all the other adaptations together. And let's face it, habitat selection isn't very interesting if you're working with sponges and corals. Past the larval stage, there's stuff on the rock, and you can tag them, and monitor them, and track them all the time, and they aren't moving. Right? But fish get up and go. So using transmitters, and thanks to Brian's wife, we have this nice image of the transmitter in the body cavity of a gay. But we've done a number of studies that have established that within at least the experimental reefs that we could use, that these fish will stay resident for an average of about 10 months, and as long as 2.5 years in some cases. Right? So they stay in a location long enough for the quality of that habitat at that spot to contribute to their growth. Right? That's an important point for our scientific. They occupy a home range that while they're in residence on a reef is only about 500 meters across. And for easily half the time that they're in residence at that reef, they're staying within about 40 meters of the reef. So it's really kind of a compact piece of real estate that they're using. But work right of this showed that if you take the fish, tag them, and move them 2-3 kilometers away from their home reef, they have the capacity to return to that reef, even if you move them outside of their home range. So they develop a knowledge of what the landscape is like, not only where they're living at that point in time, but the surrounding area. And what we found is that the fish will stay in residence, and they'll leave after a period of time, and some number, about a third of the fish, will actually return many months later, or a year later, back to that reef. So as the juveniles, they're kind of spending time within a much broader landscape, selecting the habitat patches on which they'll reside, and quality of the habitat, some theory tells us, and the density of the competitors. Now, interestingly, in doing the telemetry studies, we used to think that the eastern Gulf of Mexico was one population, and that's where everything happened today. But out of the 80 fish that we tagged in the experimental reefs here, we had 2 fish show up on the other side of the world, right? This fish, about 9 months after being last seen, was far from Waterway, about Freeport, Texas. 9 months after it was last monitored at this location. You know, this fish showed up on Veracruz, Mexico, at the same time, at the proper time of the year, with the proper depth to be part of a spawning aggregation on the other side of the Gulf of Mexico 5 years later. So, what it caused us to think about is the possibility that not only is there a population over here, but the population of Gangola in this part of the world may be communicated in some fashion, back and forth. It really complicates the fisheries management in a situation when you've got what we call metapopulations, where you have to deal with population dynamics in more than one spot and figure out how they're communicating with one another. Now, let's move on to looking at a different scale of movement. We currently have a doctoral student working on a defined scale movement within the home range. Now, to orient you to this animation, and think of this as a cardboard box that you're looking at. You're looking down on an angle in the cardboard box. This part here is the bottom of the box, and it represents the seafloor, and these black panels are the sides of the box. And what we have here is a hard bottom, or sponge, soft coral community, with sand patches to it. And that red dot right there is an experimental reef in this complex landscape. And these colored dots that are bouncing around are 5-tag-A with a transmitter, and a 5-tag-A with a transmitter that sends a signal every 2 seconds. So we're getting a position fix on the location of several fish on the order of every 5 to 6 seconds for weeks at a time. And what you have, this is just a crude animation of the movement of these 5 fish over a 24-hour period, and the yellow dots are showing its position in the water column. So we're getting high resolution, very fine detailed behavioral information about the movement of animals and all their interactions, and how the experiments that have been designed has been doing is looking at how this landscape around the reef to take shelter in affects their movement and their ability to forage and grow. Right? So we're really getting into the detailed mechanisms of how they use them. Interesting information. What we hope is that by studying the fish at this scale, we'll be able to figure out the rules by which they decide when it's time to get up and leave. And then, once we figure that out, how do they figure out which way to go? Is it just, they move around, or do they actually have some kind of orientation that sets them off in a pathway that leads them to more and more habitat? So let's move into this question of behavior and its relationship to habitat quality. Gag are naturally gregarious critters. Right? They like to live in large groups. Right? Now remember I said I'm working with pre-reproductive or juvenile females. And if you were to record the sounds that these fish make while they're living in these large groups, it's just this constant chatter. I don't want to draw any inferences about but it's just, in contrast to a lot of other fish that have distinctive sounds, and I'll talk about that in one of those at the end, the gag are just constantly chattering, and they form loose dominance hierarchies according to size while they're in residence on the reef. Now, to give you some perspective on this video, that's an experimental reef patch that's about 4 yards by 4 yards square. There's over 150 gag shown in this video, with half of them being above the legal size limit at the time that this was taken. Right? That's representative of the kinds of densities we've seen on some natural reef habitat. This is not an artifact necessarily of the experiment situation. But you can see down here what happens when they're highly disturbed. They use shelter to get between them and put shelter between them and the source of the disturbance, whether it's a predator or a diver. They love spear fishing. And they're always moving about like that. And when they really get agitated, they'll pack in tightly. But at those high densities, there's real trade-offs. They will literally prefer to live around the reef that has a lot of abundant cabin space to pack into when it's necessary and give up the opportunity to grow by having more competitors for food, and then to live in lower densities with less shelter and enjoy greater growth rates. Right? The reason is, in a high concentration, not only are they getting just a little bit less of food in competition with those they're living with, but the quality of the food also seems to change. And gang prefer to eat fish when they're at the size shown in the video. They'll feed on what we affectionately term big fish. And that will be the bulk of their consumption during the warmer months when the big fish are around. They'll feed on other fish, but at the higher densities, they'll switch over to a higher proportion of crabs in their diet. The crabs don't have the same caloric content, the same energy value as fish, because it takes more to digest them when there's less in them. Right? And the actual volume of food change as a function of gag density. So they're selecting habitat based on the shelter it provides, and then living with the consequences of as it affects their growth. Now it's important because what we've been able to find out through these experiments, is that the trade-off between having shelter to protect them from natural mortality, predators, and having food means that they'll cover their backside not to be crude, even if it means that over their lifetime they have less of a reproductive potential, less reproductive output. In the experiments we've done, we saw a difference between reef types of a 6% difference in growth rate and a 15% difference in relative rate. Now, a 6% difference in growth rate over the period of years it takes a gag to mature results in a fecundity or an egg production of hundreds of thousands of offspring per individual. The condition, in relative weight, is a measure of condition. It's an index that standardizes the weight of the fish for the length of the fish, so you can make comparisons of how plump they are. Yeah, the plumper the fish, the better the condition. I keep trying to tell my wife I'm in the best condition of my life, and she doesn't believe it. It's one of those things that the condition affects their reproductive performance. A fish in poor condition is likely not going to join the spawning aggregation in a given year. A fish in poor condition is likely not going to produce as many broods or egg batches in a given year. Gag are batch spawners. That means they'll produce multiple batches in any given spawning season. And they're also stick spawners, meaning that not every female reproduces every year. A lot of whether they're going to reproduce or not and how many batches they're going to reproduce is a function of the condition, that is, the energy reserves that they accumulate during the non-breeding season. And so habitat quality can affect not only the growth and the survival of the individual, but that individual's contribution to the reproduction of the population as a whole. That's why habitat is becoming increasingly important in the considerations of fisheries management. As there are fewer fish, we'll have to manage greater and greater exploitation of the fish. Squeezing every bit of potential out of the population has become important, and so this kind of work has become interesting to the fisheries managers, whereas 20 years ago, we got knocked off. And it doesn't matter, we'll just regulate ag limits and open seasons and things like that, slot limits and size limits. Speaking of fishing, one of the questions we had was, well, what are the effects of fishing on artificial reefs? Prior to the experiment that's portrayed in this slide, the state of Florida had a policy that if you built an artificial reef with public funds, you have to advertise its location so everybody would have access to it. It makes good public policy sense to do that. Right? We said, wait a minute. If the attraction production question has any validity on the side of you're simply improving the efficiency of the harvest, right? You're just increasing the fishing mortality. well then, if your intent is to benefit the fishery stock, publishing the coordinates could increase that mortality and offset any gain you have either on the biological performance from improved habitats. So you say, well, what happens if you don't advertise? You don't exclude people from going to an artificial reef, but you simply don't tell the world where it is. And so in our experimental system, we opened up about a third of our reefs to public fishing and then monitored the abundance of gag. This is just one piece of the data from Steve Larson's thesis. Now, I do need to tell you that this being and the homecoming at the University of Florida, I want you to notice Steve's gator visor. He's a good gator. But Steve analyzed the data over a period of in this part of the experiment, before the reefs were opened up, and within 2 years of the reefs being opened up, and then 6 to 8 years later, I can tell you that once the coordinates of the reefs were published, the size structure of gag on those published reefs is truncated right at the legal limit. Remember that video? Half the fish there were above the legal limit within 9 months of publishing the coordinates. The legal fish was essentially taken from each and every one of those reefs. And some of the reefs, and I won't tell you which counties they were adjacent to, but some of those reefs, the size distribution is truncated even below the legal limit. But what this showed us was publishing or not publishing has an effect on what the reef is able to do ecologically. But over time, even if they're unpublished and the public is aware that they're out there, they will be found and they will be fished. Right? That's just common sense. But even with that, there's still a difference between the ones that were published and the ones that were not published. Now, in this experiment, the public knew the full spatial design of the reefs. They had a lot of information available for them. If they found one patch reef, it was almost guaranteed to find all the others in the vicinity. And cut that away in the back of your mind. It plays into the strategy for how you might build reefs for fisheries conservation objective. Now, back to the theory. You thought I was done with this. Alec McCall was with World Fisheries up in the Pacific Northwest. For his dissertation, developed a mathematical model for a population. He was focused on sardines and other pelagic fishes. He wanted to know, well, could we take these concepts from behavioral ecologists and factor them into a population dynamics model and help to explain the distribution of the population? And he came up, although he's got a lot of math in his work, thank goodness he provided the rest of us a graphical representation of essentially what it does. You think of a basin of a lake or a pond, with an irregular bottom, right? And the habitat quality increasing with the depth. Right? So the highest habitat quality would be represented down here. The lowest habitat quality would be up here where the sea is located, and there's something in between. Then think of the water level as the population size. According to his mathematical analyses, validated with data from the sardine fisheries, as the population goes up or down, the distribution of fish among habitat quality should change. The highest habitat quality should always remain saturated. The lowest habitat quality should only be occupied at the highest population levels because it's spillover density. Right? And the intermediate habitat quality should be occupied, but according to the overall abundance of the population. This concept, this theory, leads to some predictions that are useful to fisheries management. And this is my second and final data slide, okay? So bear with me. One of the predictions from that basin model would be that in a declining population, undergoing overfishing, say, a declining population, the abundance on high-quality habitat should decline at a slower rate than the abundance on lower quality habitat. For the statisticians, the slope of the line should be different. So the other way is that in a growing or recovering population, as abundance increases, the higher quality habitat should gain fish and increase in numbers faster than the lower quality habitat. And what we have graphed here is an analysis from our experimental reef system in which we know based on prior results, looking at the behavior of the fish and how they perform and where their preferences are, that we have relatively high quality habitat in the 16 feet patches, relatively low quality habitat in the 4 feet patches, although that's still higher quality habitat than much of what's naturally available. And over the 10 years, we now have 2010 data currently being analyzed, but over this 9-year period, indeed the prediction about a decline in grouper population shows exactly the results the theory would predict. Furthermore, this kind of fisheries-independent information on the trends in a population factor directly into the stock assessments and the management decisions of the fisheries management councils. So, what we're suggesting is that by controlling and knowing the quality of the habitat, you can improve the precision of the data that goes into the stock assessments. Now, I show this particular slide because it's statistically a model of best fit, and you'll notice it's not fit to a linear trend, but what they call the stats folks call a quarter trend. In other words, it takes into account changes in the curving of the population. The high quality habitat showed a decline and then an increase up to about 2005 and then it dropped off again. That tracks directly with the latest bag stock assessment, which the population models overall in the eastern Gulf of Mexico showed that indeed the population had been declining and then the management actions were leading to a recovery, but then in 2005, not only did we have that horrible year of hurricanes, but there was a massive red tide hitting the eastern Gulf of Mexico. And it resulted in a lot of displacement and mortality of reef fish, a large part of the shallow continental shelf. And they modeled in the stock assessment, they modeled that mortality into the population models and showed the same kind of decline. So the data from our experimental system tracks directly with what fisheries managers and stock assessment scientists from NOAA were seeing in their overall population models. Now, what these results also showed was that indeed the numbers started going back up here again on the highest quality habitat as predicted by theory. But this wasn't just fish redistributed from other places. These are almost all small fish in small size classes that are characteristic of 1 or 2 year old fish. We had their class, their 2 year classes in succession, and we're starting to see those young fish show up on our reefs. And so, this is of great interest to the folks that are charged with doing fisheries independent monitoring, so that's that would inform the stock assessments that management of our fisheries. Now, switching gears from that list to the esoteric information. We have been looking, I'm wanting to point at the computer screen, but I can't see the computer screen. So we've been able to use the artificial reefs as experiments on a real-world scale. It's also given us information that allows us to go out and evaluate habitat quality that's naturally occurring on the shallow continental shelf. So this would be the natural habitat, this would be the artificial reef habitat, and in both cases, what you have across the top are screen captures for side-scan sonar imagery, high-resolution side-scan sonar. And just to give you, a sense of scale, these little white marks here are approximately 5 meters apart. So that, that 5 meters there, and it gives you a sense of scale. This type of habitat right here would be characteristic of what you see in the imagery there. And you can see that there's a lot of variation in the physical complexity of the reef habitat on the continental shelf. There's low complexity hard grounds, right? And there's high complexity, even to the point of having a sinkhole to fit with you more. Now, the kind of cavity and crevice and structure that occurs on, let's say, on this image, with that piece of real estate, which is about 65 feet of water, You know, the geologists tell us that kind of weathering of rock doesn't occur subtidally. Right? It would have had to have occurred at a lower sea level stand where those rocks were exposed to aerial weathering. You see this kind of, same kind of structure along the banks of the Suwannee River. Right? So we're looking at geological features offshore that once were exposed to air and are now part of the sea floor. It's interesting to the geologists, it's habitat for grouper. Right? But by being able to get images like this of locations, we were able to set up a sampling design where we could go out and sample natural reef habitat that differed in quality according to things that were important to the reef fish. But the results weren't what we were expecting. We sampled high-quality habitat, medium-quality habitat, low-quality habitat, across that spectrum of physical complexity. And here's two sites that were sampled that are of high-quality habitat. This was a fairly small, complex feature that was relatively isolated in southwest CBP. Brian's probably thinking, you dog, you got one of my favorite numbers. Right? And this was a somewhat larger but more physically complex piece of reef off the Skagit Fjord. Right? But this was in an area that had a lot more of these kinds of features. Both of these were high quality habitat. If theory was correct, we should expect to find an abundance of egg on both of these types of habitat. But what we found was, you know, reasonable on this one, and this was one of only two of the 20 sites we sampled that had densities of egg comparable to what had been seen decades earlier. And the size structure of those gags suggests that somebody knew what that rock was and just weren't telling everybody to fish it. On the other hand, this reef and a number of them like this reef had zero or less than a handful of gag present on the reef. Theory, idea of predistribution theory, which, by the way, is an assumption in virtually every population model used in fisheries management. The ideal predistribution is the pattern that you would expect as a consequence of the behavior of the fish. And they assume that pattern exists so they can ignore all the spatial variation that goes into their demographics. Right? But what we're suggesting from the data that we have is that the fish may be behaving according to the theory, but because fish move between habitat patches far slower than fishermen do, the resulting pattern that you would expect never has a chance to manifest itself. And we don't yet know what the consequences of violating that implicit assumption of our population models is going to be for the fisheries management, but it may be factoring in some of the current conditions of the gag. One of the consequences of this realization that fishermen are very efficient predators and they'll move among reef patches in order to maintain their catch. They'll fish a location and keep returning to that location. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? And they'll keep going there as long as it continues to produce. There comes a point where it's no longer productive for them and they'll move on. And they'll return to that site occasionally, right? And if it's still not productive, they'll move on. Right? And once we start talking about these results with fishing club and members, they're going, oh yeah, there's a lot of places we don't even bother stopping at. So the catch per unit effort, which is part of the fisheries dependent data that drive our population models for fisheries management, it is a result of what technically we call hyperstability. The catch per unit effort can be maintained at a fairly constant level even while the population is declining because of the way the fishing fleet moves to maintain their catch. And the kinds of fish that are most vulnerable to this type of effect are the kinds of fish that behave like gag do. The ones that are highly aggregated, very gregarious, and occur in locations that can be predicted. That is, you know where there's a rock outcropping, there's a good chance there's going to be a reef fish there. And because they stay in residence for a period of time, there's a good chance if you don't catch it today, you'll catch it tomorrow. And those are the kinds of fish that are really vulnerable to hyperstability and seeing the population drop, even when the catch data don't suggest it's on that bad decline. Now, to get a handle on the habitat distribution in northeastern Gulf of Mexico, what we have here are the track lines from cruises in which we've drug a side-scan sonar across the continental shelf to record the seafloor. Nobody has enough money to map the entire seafloor, so we're using these transects as a way to estimate the distribution and abundance of habitat that there was in a varying quality across this part of the world. Right? So we have a whole lot of data coming in about habitat distribution and how it changes with depth and geographic location. That's important because we have reef systems that are part of a larger scale experiment that are going in. Now, this line right here, you can see that, that's where the experiments were run that I've just been talking about. The line right here is a side scan track that runs along the line of reefs that we built 5 years ago that bracket the Big Bend of Florida. And this winter, we're going to be putting in place an experimental treatment in this part of the world to see if we can enhance the habitat of tuna fish to allow them to grow better as they move off to the reproductive side. This gives you an idea. So we're looking at the natural landscape of habitat on a broad scale, and then we're experimentally manipulating 100 square miles off of steam hatchery the availability of quality habitat that in previous experiments has resulted in the fastest growth rates. Right? So this is an ecosystem scale manipulation of habitat quality for juvenile bedding. These blue dots are the locations, and everybody's right down the coordinates so you can go out there and fish. These blue dots are the locations of standardized reefs that were placed out there intentionally to be monitoring stations, and we've got now 4 years of data, and we expect to continue that on for the next decade to actually monitor the output of this expansive nursery ground and look for a spatial signature in these monitoring reefs of the fish who transit through and spend part of their early life in an area that affords them a faster growth rate. So, in making a comparison of the fish and one here, taking into account a lot of what we call covariates about the availability of natural habitat, the movement of fish across the shelf, a number of factors, we hope to be able to determine whether this kind of strategy for artificial reconstruction can improve the performance at a scale that's of consequence to the population. And this is just in terms of the overall geographic scale of the GAG population, this is small scale. But in terms of an experiment, that's 100 square miles, and we plan to place within that 100 square miles 500 of these reefs that are small, meaning they're hard to find, they're hard to fish. They also are of a size that provides cavity space for shelter, but a higher growth rate because the densities of fish aren't too high. And we'll be putting 450 or 500 clam reefs in that 100 square mile in a random pattern so that it's kind of a needle in a haystack. And the area is not closed to public fishing. We're just hoping that the folks who happen to find our experimental reefs are as selfish with their locations as they were when I asked them for coordinates for sites to go sample as part of my studies. If everybody does what we expect them to, the fishing mortality should be passively managed and the growth rates should be improved, resulting in a higher performance condition. So that's the strategy there. This was a project that was conceived in the late 1990s. It took us 4 years of negotiations, 2 years of permit review to get the permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do this kind of experiment. The funding for the construction is coming entirely from the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation, from their artificial reef program, and the funding for the sampling is coming from no officials. So we've got a federal state university partnership in trying to evaluate whether there's any way we can improve the performance at a population level. All right, so a little bit of comparison. I've been talking a lot about him. Right? Let's contrast that to the other grouper that's common, the red grouper. Right? I can't tell the difference in a fish sandwich. Right? But they sure as heck are different animals in the water. Right? Jagger and Gregarious, they're both protagonists from Netflix, and they're both startups too young. They, we know, have this spatial-like history where there's a big distance between the spawning population and the spawning stock and the nursery grounds. We don't know that much about red grouper, but it doesn't appear as though they have that kind of same spatial-like history. Right? The biggest difference is these guys, gals. These gals are very aggressive. They set up residence in a solution pit or cavity, and they ward off interlopers. They fight to maintain that location. They'll even attack other fish and drive them away. When you record the sounds they produce, whereas these gals are just chattering away and doing nothing, everybody's cool, they bark. And so what happens is, where while these fish are all clumped together, making it easier to fish, these tend to distribute more widely over the seafloor. That's one of the reasons these folks are well designed for long line fishing. When you string out a line of hooks on the seafloor, the spacing on that hooks of those hooks. Makes it very efficient for catching red grouper. That's not a very good fishing strategy for catching gas. The point in making this contrast between how red grouper behave and use habitat and as a result distribute themselves in space, and how gag behave and use habitat and distribute themselves in space, is that if you are going to think about a reef design or a strategy that would improve the habitat quality for gags, which is what I've been talking about, it would not be the same strategy that you would use for something like red grouper. The red grouper, having that concentration of cavity space, doesn't do you any good. That's a lot of wasted material. On our experimental reefs, we had red grouper present, but there was rarely more than one or two fish per catch group. Right? They were statistically over-dispersed. Right? If you were going to enhance seafloor for the red grouper, you'd probably want to create the equivalent of widely spaced solution holes or cavities that would be suitable for individuals, rather than trying to concentrate them all in where their behavior would be working against them. The best advice the research community has been able to give in state agency charged with managing the state's reef program is one size does not fit all. Have people think deeply about which particular fish they're interested in enhancing, what the behavior and habitat requirements are for that fish, and then design everything for that, realizing that there's going to be trade-offs. We can increase gag, but one of the consequences of increasing gag with the reef systems that we've been using is that it comes at the expense of some of the other fishes that might occupy reef habitat, like sea bass go in the tank, like grunt start to drop off, sand perch are eliminated in the immediate vicinity. One strategy for all fish ends up with none of them really benefiting any great degree. Now, to wrap up, this is a diagram from a chapter of a book that was published in 2000. And I was asked to provide a chapter that was giving some advice on how to build into the reef project planning stage the ability to evaluate the artificial reef. And we went a little bit beyond that. Most traditional reef construction projects start with a good idea. There's some reason that people want to build reefs. Mostly it's because they want to have more fishing opportunities. It sounds like a good idea, but it's a vague concept. And it moves from this vague idea and concept of desire to do good directly into, what do we have, where can we put it, and, oh gosh, let's get going. and then it's off to the disruption. This is the pathway that is still characteristic of most of the reconstruction activity in the city. What we're suggesting is, okay, once you have the good idea and recognize the need, take a step back and think about how the structure you're going to put in place is going to change the physical environment, could it change the ecological environment, could it change the behavior of the fish that you're interested in, could it change the behavior of the fishermen that are likely going to use that reef, and take that background knowledge and build it into the design of your reef. Build it into the objectives you have and how you lay it out. We started with that message a decade ago, and this is this past June, a guidebook for local reef builders, and that is county coordinators in charge of artificial reef projects at the local level, now have a guidebook that was funded with NOAA funds for the Southeast Coral Reef Initiative. And I was the editor of the book, one of the contributors. There were 15 contributors to this guidebook. And they included members of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, NOAA Fisheries Habitat Division, Department of Environmental Protection, the state of Florida. Virtually all of the agencies that either have to act on or comment on the approval process for artificial reef projects, as well as the five coordinators of the artificial reef programs in Southeast Florida. So local, state, and federal partners were all part of this process, trying to come up with, we were shooting for best management practices and realized, there's a lot we don't know, and we really have to tailor it to a particular setting and objectives. So we backed off best management practices and set guidelines. But now at least there's a document that captures that accumulated knowledge and wisdom in one location. And it's to be used by not only the county coordinators for the artificial reef programs, the ones that actually make it work at local level, but also the offices that they have to work with in getting permits and use. So the kinds of concepts that we've been talking about tonight are built in into the guidance that's provided in some of the chapters here, along with some very practical things about how you send a ship, and without hurting somebody or wrecking a reef. And how do you buoy so that you're not spending all your money on buoy maintenance if you're going to have mooring buoys at a location that's used by divers? Some very practical information, but also the ecological background, so that hopefully at the local level, with continued effort, we can start moving into more scientific and ecological design for the habitat enhancement. It's very popular in both programs. So with that, I want to thank you for spending time with us here. I don't know anything about the sand on that side. Yes, sir. How you doing? By comparison, very localized. Right? So there's a mismatch in the scale. And where reefs are effective as a fisheries management tool is in primarily the user satisfaction, angler success, angler satisfaction, accessibility, how far you have to run to get to the fishing grounds, how much fuel it takes to get to the fishing grounds. So in terms of the socioeconomic aspects of fisheries management, they have an implicit or an understated value in that. The irony is that socioeconomic part of fisheries management is underrepresented in the federal fisheries management process. With all of our fisheries being fully exploited or overexploited, you know, the greatest attention is being paid into the condition of the fish population as a biological or ecological entity. Right? And because the focus is on the fish population rather than the fishing, you know, fishing returns, the mortality that's associated with the reef, the fishing mortality that's associated with an artificial reef, is just rolled into all the fishing mortality at the scale of the population as a whole. So that, you know, whether there's an increased fishing mortality on an artificial reef or not, from a stock level, it's irrelevant because that mortality comes out of the wash. And that's the rationale of those who do population dynamics for fisheries management. Well, it all comes out of the wash because mortality is mortality, and it's all aggregated at population level. Now, where it's going to become increasingly important because of concern over the stock and the recognition that there is a spatial dynamic to these populations. Increasingly, we're seeing the fisheries managers wanting and asking for spatial management options. Zoning, marine protected areas, that's almost a bad word in some communities, and area closures for periods of time. That's what, you know, you basically know this goes. And so when you start manipulating on a spatial scale or doing different things in different locations to manage according to the local conditions, that's when habitat manipulation or enhancement starts to play an important part. That's why this kind of experiment we're using in the steam hatching fisheries management area becomes increasingly important. Because if it works there, then it opens up the possibility of managers looking at their spatial models instead of just an aggregate model for the entire eastern Gulf of Mexico and asking, well, now where can we get the greatest growth? Is what portions of the overall habitat are contributing, you know, the lion's share of the reproductive potential? And how can we manage that different than this other part that while there may be fish there and support fishery, may not be contributing as much to the overall reproduction? So those are the kinds of spatial questions that are being asked now. And that's why this kind of science has been funded by NOAA Fisheries, not because it's going directly into artificial reefs as a tool, but because it's looking to give them options in the future, you know, realizing where the management game is going. Did I dance around it yet?
Yeah.
Okay. How efficient are sunken ships versus concrete structures? We're talking big ships or little ships? Okay. Realizing that what a lot of the reef fish are looking for are the nooks and crannies that are scaled to the jacks that come in.
Yeah.
And getting up into the water column and having an open structure up in the water column does seem to be an enhancement for the fish that are oriented to the structure and that serves as the force of what you want. Now, from an economic viewpoint, and considering ecotourism or the appeal to divers, ships by far, you know, are a preferred dive site for the kinds of reefs. And you can create, you know, a lead with a ship, you know, a little fact, you know, how valuable it is. You know, we have a saying that a calorie saved is a calorie earned. With daddy, you know, they'll move with respect to reef according to the flow and stack up, you know, kind of like the stationary wave at the water parks. You know,